Good morning and welcome to Grad Talks, a series of conversations with graduate students about their work, produced in collaboration with the University of Manitoba Graduate Students Association. I'm Michael Elves, and I am joined this morning by Jill Budefeld. Welcome, Jill.
Thank you for having me.
So I always like to start with kind of if there was an inflection point or a period in your life that kind of led you towards the course of study that you're in. Was there, a person in your life who kind of opened your eyes to the field of research or an experience you had? It might have been something in undergrad. It might have been even before you ever entered university at all. What led you to where you are now as a researcher?
I don't think there'd be any one particular point. I did grow up on a farm, so I always wanted to work outside. I always wanted to do something to do with nature, and having this connection to places and outdoor spaces was always kind of my goal. My first encounter with research would have been as an undergrad. So I did an undergraduate thesis with Dr. Michael Campbell, who does a lot of work in sustainable tourism. So that would have been sort of that first encounter with research. I, at that point, had no intention of doing a master's or a PhD. I had a job for a few years. I actually worked for the University of Manitoba in extended education and EAL.
Mm.
So English as an additional language.
Yeah.
And it was a great job. I just found that I really was not well suited for office life.
Okay.
And I wanted to do something that was a little bit more outdoors, a bit more applied. And I just worked backwards thinking, what kind of training do I need if I want to work for parks or if I want to work outside in environmental education program planning? What does that look like? So I wound up doing a master's in recreation management with that goal in mind, mm-hmm. where I met Dr. Christine Van Winkle, and I just immediately was in awe of her. She was kind of everything I wanted to embody, this brilliant, smart academic who does relevant work in her community, and I just loved research and doing projects with her, and that was sort of the snowball start of it. She helped me get a lot of funding so I could come back to school full-time, and once I realized that I could do research and be a grad student and have it pay like a job would pay, mm-hmm. I was pretty hooked at that point.
So it was never going to be farming, though?
No.
No.
Farming is incredibly risky. It's incredibly, it's emotionally draining and stressful. When my parents retired, they were different people. It's a wonderful job. It's a very, it's a really, I think, gratifying way to make a living and to work, but it's incredibly stressful, and I just had no intention of being hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars in debt for most of my life and then hoping that it will turn out okay in the end.
Right.
Yeah.
So you said you went into the working world and then realized kind of maybe the office life wasn't for you. At that point, you start kind of sussing out, and like you said, you want to work outside, so you kind of have to work backwards as to what gets you there.
Completely.
What is that process like? Are you looking at syllabi and figuring out what courses are on offer and does this have a path, or if there's a specific job, what requirements do I need? How do you go about kind of infilling?
Yeah, so that's the really hard part. I think a lot of us, my parents were really big on just go to university, that being the overarching goal. I was the first person to get to go to university. I don't think they really knew what that meant so much. So getting a degree was great, but then what do you do with it afterwards? And yeah, I found that really great job and all these things, but then, yeah, wanting something more. So I was really specific then the next time thinking about, okay, I want these specific types of jobs. I want to run interpretive programs. And I really did a lot of working backwards of saying, these are the things I like about my current work right now. Mm-hmm. I want them to at least be partially outdoors. I need to not sit in an office all day long. I have to have more movement in my everyday life.
Right.
Then the next part was, what does that look like? Am I managing resources and areas like that? Am I doing interpretation or program planning? How can I work outside in different capacities? So then I narrowed it down to what type of work I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. And that was very specifically, I knew I wanted to do something about educating people about the environment to learn more about it and to learn how to perhaps interact with it in a more ethical and kind of meaningful way.
Right.
Since a lot of people are really disconnected from their environments. So that was my goal in life. So how do you work backwards? And I looked at kind of what tasks I wanted to do. And then, yeah, I just started checking different programs. So what sort of degrees did I need to get those jobs? A master's degree. So I looked at all the different master's programs, sussed out kind of which ones I felt would be a good fit for the types of jobs that I wanted to be applying for, mm-hmm. afterwards. And the master's in recreation management was really well suited because I didn't want to do just resource management. I wanted to do something that involved visitors and engagement and people learning about the natural world, not just sort of managing parks and protected
areas.
And
not like pure science.
Right. It had to have a social science component to it. So people and parks, people and the natural world, not just one or the other.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of the resource management and people I've talked to kind of end up on sort of the like business side of resource management. Right.
Right.
Like it's getting trained to extract or things like that.
Yeah.
So working with people then obviously one of the bigger things, like not just being stuck in an office, but like socializing.
Yeah, so I'm actually a really big introvert. So I knew that I wanted to do things that would, I'm maybe an extroverted introvert. So I have my moments where I like to go out and interact with people. But I like to do a lot of the pre-planning. So things where I can deliver a program, or if I can come up with interpretive material where I know that a lot of that is going to be on
controlled
my own.
Interactions.
Yeah, and then some of it's going to be out and interacting with people, but in a limited span of time and place. So I knew that very much about myself, and I think that's why I'm really well suited to graduate work as well, is that I like to have, you know, time on my own to think about it and plan things that's separate from sort of that front space. And that was also what was hard about some office work, is that there's a lot of front space interaction, so you're interacting with perhaps people all day long, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas graduate life, some of my jobs have been to come up with ideas, right? So you have to come up with a solution to a problem. So you sit there, and it's a lot more in your own head. And I really like that type of work. So I think knowing what type of work is well suited to you is also really important in finding meaning in that.
Right. So you mentioned that you'd done, you know, a research project in your undergrad.
Yeah.
Did any of what you learned through that prepare you for graduate studies, or was it like a whole new set of skills that you had to learn to do research at the graduate level?
You know, it did. Dr. Campbell was really adamant at making that a really good project. So my lit review was extremely extensive for an undergraduate thesis.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really good preparation. His standards were really high, so that helped. I tried to administer a survey to different parks management officers. And the paperwork to get that done was impossible. I had a year to do this project, and I just couldn't get approval. I couldn't get my ethics in place. So learning all of the kind
of... So was that university paperwork, or is that like Parks Canada paperwork?
Parks Canada paperwork. So I could get the ethics approved here,
mm-hmm.
but then getting them to work with me, there was a lot of sort of closed doors at the time. There's a lot, really lacking a lot of transparency, and it was really hard to get that research done. Like, it was a simple survey just sent out to parks management officers, and I just could not get it approved. So learning that working with organizations and communities that maybe have different agendas, or your research isn't necessarily even a priority to them, and
mm-hmm.
learning how to communicate how important the research that you're doing is, how to make that accessible, and then also how to navigate some of that red tape became really important in being successful in my master's and doctoral work.
Making things accessible is a theme that comes up in, yeah, so you participated in the 3MT.
Yes.
And accessibility and making knowledge accessible, I think, is kind of the crux of your presentation. Is that just personal, like, ideology, or is that something that you've learned having dealt with kind of inaccessible groups or structures?
I think both.
Yeah.
So my dad is a farmer, was an expert, right? Expert in his field, knew an awful lot about a lot of environmental issues, science-based things, but maybe didn't have the language to support some of those ideas and concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So the terminology wasn't the same as what we would find in a university. And I think he often wasn't taken seriously because he didn't sound like a professional,
right.
Yet he was an expert. Right. And I think there's often this discrepancy between academia and the real world. And we don't often value expertise if it's not backed by this academic background. And so what I really want to do is make these sort of realms of knowledge accessible and more integrated into societies and communities where we value other people's local and traditional knowledges and bring them into our work. So that's personally really important to me, but also through this process of graduate school is saying to partners, here is what I can bring to the table, but then, you know, what does that mean, right? How do we make sure that that's meaningful to our partners that we work with? So I've worked with the Assiniboine Park Zoo and a lot of festivals and events through the lab that I work in, and how we make that, you know, if we run a bunch of statistics and structural equation analyses, what does that mean to them at the end of the day, and how is that helpful to them? And so I think being able to communicate that is everything, right? If we want to make our research meaningful and valuable to the communities that we live in and work in, we have to be able to say what that actually means in kind of commonplace language, not just technical jargon. So yeah, I think it's both, right?
Yeah, and that seems to come up against an impulse within academia, I think, to create or like parcel off knowledge, like to create a set of languages that only those people who've really studied it understand, or to like hoard knowledge in some way that, you know, this is my research, right? Or this is our department's work. And that kind of flies in the face of, you know, the fact that not everyone has those, like you said, there's traditional knowledge. There are, you know, firsthand knowledge that a farmer has that he, you know, doesn't speak about praxis, but, you know, when push comes to shove, practice is praxis, right? That there's, this real kind of interplay and sometimes oppositional force between academia and the world at large. And yet the research that academia is doing is so important to the world at large. So you mentioned the lab that you work with. Maybe you can tell us kind of like what exactly goes on in the lab.
Sure. So I've worked in the Leisure and Tourism Lab for the last 6 years now. And we do all different kinds of mixed methods research. So I think one of the commonplace misconceptions of social science knowledge is that it's perhaps just all qualitative or only sort of experience-based or case study-based. But we do mixed methods. So we do everything from, like I was saying, structural equation modeling and survey-based research and data to interviews. We do something called personal meaning maps, which is like a brainstorming activity. And we can analyze these in sort of really unique and creative ways. And we analyze a lot of different types of data. So we've done a lot of research with festivals and events. So my advisor, Christine Van Winkle, has been deeply involved in the festival and event world. So we've done a lot of work on mobile device use in festivals and events. Mm-hmm. So they're huge economic drivers, obviously, festivals for local communities, but they're often run on these shoestring budgets with only really a few full-time staff year-round. Mm-hmm. And yet they're expected to put on these huge displays that are supposed to be super professionally done and have all of the modern technology integrated. And yet there's really no research on sort of what technology is beneficial and what is detrimental to the experience. Right. So when you're having a first-hand encounter, whether it's in nature or a festival or whatever, often you just want to be present. You want to be fully there and experience it and enjoy it. But we want to add so many things to add to the experience that we don't think really how we're doing it. And so our research has looked at how mobile devices can be beneficial, but also perhaps detrimental to these encounters. So we did survey-based research, interviews, these brainstorming activities, all different types to sort of tease out some different ideas. And so we did some theory testing at one level. It's called the Unified Theory of Technology and Adoption. And so we contribute to that in knowing kind of what ways are most beneficial to adopt different technologies in different settings. Mm-hmm. And then we also did some more interview type of research and looking at, and focus groups looking at, okay, did your device take away from the experience? How can we add to it? If there's an app, in what ways is that app useful? Can it show you what tense different events are happening in and help direct you? Or is it a good communication tool? At what point is it just distracting and taking away from your encounter? And so really what we did was we found a lot of useful information saying, here's your limited budget. Here's the best way to adopt technologies and ways to enhance the experience and make it kind of this co-created encounter. And here are ways that maybe, you know, just encourage people to put their phones away and be present in the experience. So, and knowing that's big, right? It depends if it's a successful encounter. It depends if it's meaningful or not. And so we analyze even social media data in the lab. So we have SPSS. We have a program called Envivo, which analyzes qualitative data. And so in the lab, then we go out first into the field and collect all the data. That's obviously the fun part. We get to go to a lot of festivals and events around the province and the country. And then we come back with our data and analyze it in these software tools.
Are you approaching the festival saying we'd like to research this? Or are they coming to you saying we'd like you to research this? Or is it a combination?
It usually goes both ways. So yeah. With this one big project, it was a cross-Canada study, three major cities, and it spanned 3 years in time. In some places, we had festivals.
Oh, so there's like a longitudinal aspect, like
yes.
You were the same festival year after year?
Sometimes there are different festivals.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it depended on the purpose of the study.
Right.
Because there are three different stages. And so sometimes they come to us if they have a very specific part that they want researched, and we can incorporate that into our study, we'll do that. And then other times we'll approach them. So let's say we need a festival a certain size in the winter, or you know, a music festival or a performing arts festival, we'll ask them if they're interested in being a part of this. And we always produce then reports and sort of show them, here's the practical part of our findings, here are things you can implement, this is what we've learned from our research. And then we go and present it, obviously, at conferences and journals and that sort of thing.
So the body of knowledge that you're gathering, you're obviously then relaying to those festivals and to other, you know, groups who might be kind of experiencing the same issues. But in terms of feeding sort of the body of research for the lab, then, like, does it, like, constant churn of data and information and festivals, or like, is there kind of like building towards a goal, or like, is it kind of an ongoing project because of kind of the ephemeral nature of things like festivals and events?
So this was a 3-year study, so yeah. there were certain pieces built in. So along the way, you plan to present different findings at conferences, and then some targeted events too, like the festivals and events and management, the international conference, we try to go to that one. And then you try to publish in different journals as well as you're going. So the one that was theory testing, that we've submitted to a journal that does more sort of communications and technology adoption mm-hmm. literature. And then some of the other festival specific research goes to journals like Tourist Studies and Visitor Research.
Right. Yeah. Now, the 3MT, you talk about, you know, you start with talking about the fact that global warming is a huge issue. And how do you convey that knowledge? Like, you know, classroom teaching doesn't seem to sink in. I think a lot of social media doesn't seem to sink in. And so you just kind of talk about like experiential learning, right? That people need to kind of go out into the environment to understand the impact on the environment. this sounds like it was tailor-made for the person who grew up on a farm and wanted to go back out into the world after being at a desk. Did you kind of like carve this niche out yourself in terms of identifying this as something, or was this part of like, you know, research that was already going on in your program, or like kind of how did you land upon this area of things?
So when I first chose my master's work, I was really looking for gaps in the literature. So I was reading all the papers that I thought were sort of the most interesting around nature-based tourism and learning, mm-hmm. anything relating to those. And there's this big gap in kind of understanding, how do we get from learning to behavior change? It's often sort of suggested that this is what naturally happens in these tourism encounters or any sort of visitor experience, but there is no research showing that this is actually what happens. So my master's work looked at how do we get people to go from learning to actually making some meaningful behavior changes. So if they learned about climate change through an experience like at the zoo, where they have very direct climate change messaging, do they actually implement those activities in their everyday lives? Mm-hmm. If not, how can we build into that? So I developed something called post-visit action resources based on previous research, basically things you do after an experience that help you become more sustainable, whether it's, you know, adopting different low-flow appliances, just turning off the lights more, recycling more, biking more, sometimes very basic things to sometimes harder activities. So that was just a gap in the literature, looking at what was needed. And since then, in my PhD work, I've built on that even more. So how do we really make these experiences meaningful and transformative is the word we like to use in academia. But what that really just means is behavior change. How do we get people to, like you said, experience something and then sort of learn to care about it and know what that looks like? And really what it's about is creating these interpretive programs that are designed to do that. So it's one thing to tell people that climate change is happening, here's what it looks like. But you often get, like you were saying, we know this, we know it's happening. We have sort of this disaster fatigue, or we're not, we hear it so much that we become almost immune to it. Mm-hmm. And we really feel unempowered. We don't know what we can personally do. We think that as one person, we don't have a role in it. So the next step then is to show people what their individual role is in climate change. Mm-hmm. That often includes things like measuring your carbon footprint, knowing what your impact actually is and what that looks like. And here's how you can reduce your impact. And that's often the first step to empowering people to greater social change as well, which is a really important factor in sort of long-term climate change problems. So people often give me the argument of saying, well, recycling won't help solve climate change. No, of course not, right? But it's one small step towards sort of this mentality of recognizing that we have to have a lesser impact on our planet, that we have this sort of ultimate carbon budget. We can't go above this 2 degrees of warming. Mm-hmm. And so if we're not going to do that, we have to start making changes. And what do those changes look like? It often winds up being often simple things to start, but they gradually build up, right? So whether it builds up into personal actions and behaviors, or whether it builds up into the social movement of saying, hey, we need to use less fossil fuels.
So you're looking at what activities create that cascading kind of like first step, second step, larger step, rather than measuring out those steps, I would imagine.
Yeah. So measuring some of those steps was part of my master's work, but now I'm more interested in these overarching sort of theoretical issues of how do we get a meaningful encounter to occur? How do we get people through this experience in nature to say, wow, that was amazing. What can I do? And then right then, providing them with the next steps and the tools. And it's actually, through research, we know that there are really good ways of reaching certain visitors and saying, here are the next things that you can do. Here are some ways to empower you and to start moving towards a more sustainable future. But we also know is that some visitors are more inclined to those messages than others. So recognizing different motivations and even different life stages is incredibly important because if you're hitting people at the wrong time and they're not able to absorb those messages or they're not able to act on them, it can just be really, really frustrating. So, for example, if you're a mom at the zoo and you have three little kids and you're just doing your best to sort of keep them all alive and fed during the day, and it's really hard to take actions and do other things. But if you're a retired couple for the first time in your life, you have some time that's available, you have the financial resource to do something different and meaningful, like those are great people that can be involved in making meaningful changes. So hitting the right motivations and the right types of visitors, both at the right life stages, and targeting that messaging is super important for having it be impactful. So I don't think it's fair to say that everyone's going to be impacted the same way, but there's this really great social science behind understanding how climate change messaging can be effective and knowing how and when to implement that to the right groups of visitors who are receptive and able to act on those messages. So it's actually really simple things, right? Like giving the right sort of suggestion, say if you're on a polar bear tour, even in Churchill, having your guide saying, you know what? Your individual actions do make an impact. This is what the average person's carbon footprint looks like. Just by reducing these actions, that's how big a difference you can make. If you want to do more, here are the next steps. Here are sort of the next social actions. And meeting them at that right level of difficulty is also really important. In leisure studies, we talk about something called flow theory. It's this really cool concept where it talks about the idea that your challenge level has to also sort of meet your skill level. And that if those two don't align, you either wind up being frustrated and anxious about it or kind of bored. So there's this optimal experience that we want to hit. And that often is where we feel sort of most satisfied or that we're kind of having this really great encounter or a meaningful experience. So if you've ever played a sport, that optimal experience is you're playing, I used to play volleyball a lot. And so if you're playing with a team that was at sort of your same skill level, it was really satisfying because your skill level met the level of challenge, mm-hmm. right? And so the same thing applies in environmental education and even actions. If you're time strapped and you don't have a lot of available resources, whether time, money, otherwise, if the challenge level is up here, you're just going to feel overwhelmed. Right. But if you have more resources, more time available, that challenge also has to be higher. Right. Just saying recycle more is kind of like, well, I do that already. Right. So you have to always have that next level in place. And that's kind of this idea. It's the same thing in gaming. Right. You always have to be able to level up and have that next level of challenge available for you. And that makes it more meaningful to people as well. Right. It gives you some hope that there's something we can do about it. But that has to be backed by research. Right. We also have to tell people, here's the facts. Here's the science. This is what we know about climate change. I think that's really where we fail as scientists and social scientists, is that we become so good at knowing information that we fail to see the importance of communicating it effectively. And that it's a really important social science. But because it's a social science, it's often not taken seriously enough. But there is really good data on how we can do that more effectively. And that's really what I try to do in my work.
So is that a skill you have to then develop, is like messaging is like a research tool in some sense, because you have to figure out how not only what information is important, like, you know, especially with something like this, the flow, that you want the message to be at the level that the person coming to it can understand, but that it's like actionable or, you know, prompts a challenge. You need to get that message across. And so figuring out the way to convey it is as important as, you know, the process.
Completely, completely. And conveying that message is almost an art form, right? Like if you ever think about a tour that you've been on, your guide is instrumental in reading the audience and knowing where they're at and with their, if they're with them or not, right? Mm-hmm. So being able to read the room is an incredibly important part of that. And that's, it's hard to quantify that. Even we often talk about charisma in this field as well. The ability of someone to interact and to really engage you and pull you in is this art form, right? That's kind of hard to quantify. But having really good and really well-trained guides and knowing kind of you have to first grab their attention, right? You have to get people to see the issue, to care about it. You got to pull them in some way. You have to have a draw, mm-hmm. and then you have to be ready with the science and the facts and saying, this is actually what the impact is. Here is how you personally have an impact on that. So connecting it personally is really big, and then saying, here are some next steps. If you're already doing those things, here are the next steps after that. And then also connecting them afterwards. So saying, if you want to do more, here's how you can reach out. It's not necessarily recreating the wheel and creating all these different programs, but helping people plug into things that they're already interested in and willing to run with. And that's been a big part of what I learned. It's more about empowering people and knowing how to hit the right notes for that. But you have to also be really educated on the science behind it too, to sort of provide people with knowledge, because we live in this information age where people know about climate change, they know about these issues, but they kind of need to be steered a little bit in the right direction in terms of what messaging is going to be relevant for them.
Right. So, longer term,
yeah,
are you hoping to teach in this field, or is there like another path, you know, in practice, or what's kind of the next step for you?
So I'm planning a postdoc at the U of A next year. So that's for sure a next step. I've already taught a lot this year. So I taught a class called Earth, a User's Guide. And the tagline for that class is everything you need to know to be an informed citizen of the Earth. So it's a perfect class for this, because we do a little bit of geology, earth sciences, environmental studies, and geography, both physical and human geography. And that's a great class and an opportunity to do that, because it's a feeder class for all different types of faculties and electives. So it's a first year class, but I get students in fourth year chemistry, in fourth year music, third year geology. So I'm teaching to a hugely broad audience, but they're all learning the same sort of thing and trying to meet that level. So it's been a really good way of practicing, applying a lot of my own research and how to communicate environmental issues effectively to a very, very broad audience.
So with that broad audience, then you are trying to hit different sort of experiences and backgrounds within
Completely.
The teaching process.
Yeah, we use a lot of case studies, so a lot of it relates back to the real world. So we, in geology, we talk about different minerals and mineral use, and we relate it to people's iPhones and the minerals used in those and that technology and where those minerals actually come from, where they're mined, what those practices look like,
right,
and connect it back to them. And afterwards, people's minds are kind of blown. And once you see these things, you can't unsee them. And so I think it's a really impactful class. I got a teaching award for it last semester from my students who nominated me, which I think tells you that, like, it's reaching some people. People care. They want to have an impact. And I think that level of challenge is really important. You know, we often think about in our own lives, what are optimal experiences? What do those look like? And you would never say an optimal experience is, you know, doing watching a lot of Netflix, right? Optimal experiences are often interconnected things that are a little bit hard. So throwing out challenges to people and saying, here are some ways to live a more meaningful life or have a lesser impact on the world. You know, I challenge you to do that in your life. Think about the types of homes you buy, the communities that you choose to live in, how much transportation you're using. Build yourself a life that is, you know, going to have a lesser impact. And I think people are ready for those messages. They do, you know, we want these challenges in our lives. We don't often recognize that until we've experienced it, but that's a big part of growing, and especially at the university. You know, people are here to learn. If they take a class like that as an elective, you know that they're already interested in environmental issues and that they probably need just a little push.
Mm-hmm. So, Jill, are you on social media at all? Like, do you share your research or
I do. I have to say it's been woefully inadequate as of late, but I am on Twitter and Instagram, where I do try to share things as I go along. But done a lot of teaching.
URLs for folks?
Pardon?
Do you want to share your handles for
folks? Yeah, absolutely. My handle for Twitter, I think it's just J Budefeld, and the same for my research as well.
B-U-D-D-E-F-E-L-D?
B-U-E.
B-U-E, okay.
D-D-E-F-E-L-D. And I do try to share that. I'm also on, like, ResearchGate and a few places like that where we try to make our research more accessible.
Sure.
I've also been trying to get a short film put together to disseminate my doctoral research findings. So just like a 2 to 3 minute video that so it could be shared more broadly. So that's something I'm working on in the new year as well, because I think it's so important. I produce reports and things like that for the organizations that I work with and the public in general. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to have something that's sort of this little snippet that can be shared broadly with the audience at large. So, yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Jill, thanks very much for coming in and joining us in Grad Talks today.
Thank you very much for having me.